This podcast is brought to you by Shift Management Supervisory Leadership Certificate Course, where online learning and live web coaching bring out the very best in frontline and middle managers. Move from operations to management thinking and develop the skills for leadership, reaching your company goals at the same time. Check out our Supervisory Leadership Certificate Course on the shiftworkplace.com website today. Hello, culture and leadership connections podcast listeners. Today, I'm very excited to bring to you Rohan Nigam, who is a director in PwC's deals practice. Rohan has supported clients at various stages of the merger and acquisition lifecycle, including due diligence, integration, carve-outs, post-close support and transformation. He has over 10 years of consulting experience, specializing in pre- and post-deal merger and acquisitions, program management, process optimization, and systems integration. His work spans the USA, the Middle East, Asia, and Europe, which is very impressive for such a young person. I'm going to have to ask you about that later, Rohan, but you look like you're fresh out of high school. It's hard to believe that you're so accomplished at such a young age. Rohan has an MBA in finance and strategy from Kelly School of Business, Indiana University, and a Bachelor of Engineering, summa cum laude, in information technology from Mumbai University. Prior to joining PwC, Rohan was a technology consultant with Deloitte, management consultant at Horton International, where he advised multinational clients across many industries, including retail, industry, technology, private equity, and the public sector. Such an impressive international bio. In his spare time, Rohan loves to play golf and racquetball, and when the global pandemic permits, exploring cities and countries and trying out new cuisines and restaurants. Welcome, Rohan.
Thank you, Marianne. I'm glad to be here on this platform and talk to you and the rest of the listeners.
Great. Well, give me a little bit more information about you, Rohan, the person.
Sure, Marianne. And when I think about that question, it takes me back, I would say, about 14, 15 years, and I'll keep it short on this one. While growing up, I was always interested in the mechanics, the engineering aspect of anything. I remember in my house, just kind of getting my tool bag out and fixing a table and a chair at my parents' house. So since then, I always had an interest in engineering. That's the reason I kind of got into engineering and had a lot of interest in technology on how computers and any type of gadgets can essentially do a job for a person. So that was my foray into information technology. When I finished my bachelor's degree and got my first job at Deloitte, that's when I really was putting my graduate degree to use. And through those conversations with clients, I worked with the likes of Walmart, a lot of US public governments within the country and whatnot. During that course, I was first introduced to the mergers and acquisitions, M&A work. And through those conversations and projects is when I realized that the deals world, or the M&A world, as we call it, is something that is always dynamic. And be it a low economy, companies always sell their businesses. And if the market's up or the economy is booming, they always buy. So that's one of the industries that always intrigued me as something that always lives and keeps living. So that's the reason I kind of pursued my MBA in finance strategy with a minor in mergers and acquisitions. And then that landed me a job with PwC in the mergers and acquisitions practice. And then the past 5 years has been a time that I've been doing the work that I love the world of mergers and acquisitions. And it's a never ending learning curve. So looking forward to the next 10, 20 years in the industry as I keep progressing here.
Thank you. That was great. It makes me think that you're really in a recession-proof business, aren't you?
Yeah. I would say less recession-prone than other industries, but I have to say that over the past 9 to 10 months, where we've seen a lot of changes in the global economy across multiple industries, like, say, retail and consumer products and whatnot, the mergers and acquisitions space has been alive. And it actually not only helps companies buy and sell their divisions or other companies, but also revive their companies going into bankruptcies and whatnot. So it's essentially like when companies hit a wall, we help them. When companies want to grow, we help them. And then 3 years, when companies don't want to do anything, is also where the M&A world picks them back up. So it's kind of sort of recession-proof, but then it's always active.
Hmm. It really is dynamic because at all stages of the life cycle of any company and multiple companies, you're right there with them.
Absolutely. And to the point I made earlier, the reason I chose this, and I'm glad I chose it, maybe not all the career decisions were perfect, but then the reason I made this choice is because I love the motion, love kind of having a lot of moving pieces on my plate. So I think as a person who makes this career choice, I think what I've learned through the experience is that if it were a static industry where I have to do the same job 9 to 5 every day, that wouldn't keep me happy. It's the dynamic nature, as you pointed, of the industry, and then kind of tying that back to the way my personality is, I think that's kind of a perfect fit or a perfect marriage.
Your profession and your passion have joined forces.
Exactly. You got it.
Something else that interested me about what you said in the beginning was this piece that a company might sell a division. And I actually never thought about that until you mentioned it, but it makes sense. They might buy a division or sell a division, not necessarily an entire company, right? So can you maybe give me an estimate of what percentage of buying or selling divisions of companies is your work, and how much is it merger and acquisition for an entire merger or an entire acquisition?
For sure, Mary. And that's an interesting question. I don't get it a lot. So it's really intriguing on kind of the metrics. So as I think about it, if the total pie of the number of M&As or the deals happening in the world, right? And I'm thinking about a global metric here, because I've worked on a lot of cross-border and international deals. So on that scale of about 100%, I would say 60 to 65% are more of the full company acquisitions. And then the balance is about whatever, 35 to 40% are carve-outs or spin-offs, as we call it, where a larger company, multi-billion dollar global companies, or even local Canadian, US, India, any country companies, they want to sell a part of their non-core business. And that's kind of the balance, 35, 40%. And the one thing I would call out is that sometimes on maybe I would say 2 or 3 out of 10 occasions, we see a single company doing both. So if it's a global company which has presence across the board, is say it's a CPG, a food and beverage company. They want to keep growing in the beverage business, which is the drinks business. So what they're going to do is they will sell some divisions that they have in, say, a non-drinks business, like a cookie or a cracker or a foods business. They'll sell that business for, say, $5 billion. And once they sell it, they will use that capital to invest in their core business. So the way they see it is that they're able to, through these two deals, one selling one asset, which is the carve-out, and using that capital to buy something, they're able to move away from the non-core business and move towards the core business. So kind of in terms of a long-term strategy, it helps them kind of move more towards and monetize the industry that they're more interested in, and they see their future business growing.
Hmm. That's really important, because when you're a small business owner, people are always saying, you know, establish your core business and then don't get distracted by shiny objects. But I think that billion-dollar businesses seem to be distracted by shiny objects too, and they end up developing divisions that can be moderately successful, but in the long run, weaken them from what they really are good at and what they want to present to the world, or how they want to grow into the next industry development for the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then to your point on the multi-billion dollar companies, what I've also seen is that some of a few million dollar businesses are, say, like somewhere in the range of 50 to 100 million or whatnot, like the smaller businesses, they also keep doing this just to be able to use the same strategy of shedding or selling the non-core assets or businesses and moving more toward their future strategy and something that gets them more traction, focusing on if they want to sell something within the US, move more towards the Canadian market. So it's done for a lot of reasons, even by smaller companies, to either extend towards a more fruitful product line, a geography, acquire a different type of technology. Like COVID, for example, all of us have seen the movement in the global economy. What I've seen in the past 6 to 7 months is that a lot of the retail companies, small or big, they had big box stores where they could not reach the end consumer like you or I in our homes, because that's a gap in their business model. What they've started doing is buying smaller last mile logistics companies like a Uber Eats or a Instacart or any of these last mile apps where they have the technology, but obviously they don't have the infrastructure. So the bigger retail companies are just able to buy the smaller food apps or grocery apps to be able to deliver their products and inventory from their big stores into the customer's homes. So essentially the direct-to-consumer channel is what they're looking for. And these companies are really small, the ones they buy. Like one of the recent transactions I did, it was a six-member company, a $50 million acquisition that they made. And they were able to grow it, like I would say, 50 to 60 times, like revenue on through that app, because they had all the products. All they had to do is use the app, use the technology, sign up with like thousands of delivery people or drivers, and just push the product in people's homes. And it was really successful.
Wow. That makes me think of another question I want to ask you. Then I'm going to get to my usual questions. But you probably are the best person I've met so far to be able to make some predictions on global trends. So you must be seeing some global trends as a result of the pandemic that other people wouldn't see, like what you just mentioned now. That looks like a global trend, large companies purchasing smaller ones and the smaller ones using apps to push things out in a way that they can scale. But please correct me, because I might have missed some aspect of what you said.
No, for sure. You're absolutely right. And I wouldn't call myself someone who could predict it. I would be the richest man in the world today. But what I could say is that we do that on a regular basis. Like as deals professionals, we kind of realize where the market's going, because the deals start happening, right? Like if you look at the private equity, which market, the private equities are just for the folks on the hearing this, is that they're more of like a holding company, who keep buying and selling companies as part of their core business. So a lot of big private equity companies, be it global or country specific, they do this on a daily basis. And they have a lot of internal teams, analytics and strategy teams that actually do this on a day-to-day basis. They monitor the market. They see what's happening, what's moving within the market, and they make predictions of where the market's going to go. Like the small example that I alluded to earlier around retail companies or grocery companies, like the big giants like Walmart's and Costco's, and these companies are buying like these smaller companies because they want the technology. So that's one of the trends. The other trend we saw was that I've personally seen and worked on is many of the high-end luxury stores. Given the global economy is not doing well, people are very concerned about their jobs, their future earning capacity. So they're curtailing personal spending. So if I were a customer who would essentially buy, say, a $2,000 pen, for example, from, say, Gucci, I would think twice, hey, do I need to spend $2,000 on this thing? Can I spend $200 and get done? So the companies or the brands that sell the high luxury products in the thousands of dollars are not doing very well because of the consumer behavior today. So that's another example of how we kind of think about, hey, how has the COVID coronavirus economy impacted a lot of industries? So kind of monitoring this, these are a couple of examples, but a lot of such scenarios that we keep monitoring on almost a daily basis to be able to see where the business is going, where should we make our bets, where should we invest, where should we focus on? And I'm sure a lot of other non-deals professionals do the same across other industries as well.
Well, I need to bring you onto a webinar too to talk about how people can use an understanding of these trends to create their own contingency plans. I think that would be really useful. I'm just really enjoying this. To me, this is just fascinating. And I just wanted to ask you a little bit about that, you know, luxury products. In the past, in recessions, what we saw is that the luxury market still performed well. And then also low-cost items, often referred to as the lipstick and beer phenomenon, would sell and essential services would continue, but things in the middle would not do so well. But now what you're saying is that the luxury industries are not doing so well. That seems to be something, unless I'm mistaken, that we haven't seen even in wars. In world wars, there were still luxury items were still selling to people who could afford them. But you're saying that's not the case now.
Yeah, I would say, given the research and kind of the data that I've seen, is that the beer and lipstick, that's definitely going to sell. People need groceries and homes to kind of be able to run their day-to-day life. So that's taken care of. The mid-segment, which is the bulk of the population, those segment has curtailed spending to a certain extent, I would say 30-40%, to focus on more of the essential items that, hey, if I need a pair of pants, that's when I'm going to go. But if before COVID, before this whole change of behavior happened, I would still go and buy something even if I didn't need it. It's going to line my closet and I'm going to use it at some point because I'm going to be out, I'm going to be going to work. So I'll still be using it. So that's the second segment. And then to your point on the luxury segment, that's been like the rich who can afford it, who don't get impacted as much, like a lot of industries don't. They're still going to make those purchases. But then what I'm trying to say is that has reduced. So it's reduced not by like 80-90%, but it's still been reduced by another like 15-20%, where the big dollars that were being invested in huge real estate projects or hotels and say cruise ships, all of that, the luxury items, those have been reduced. Like no one's given the regulations, cross-border regulations or local country regulations, no one's going to go on cruise ships at all. So that industry, which was meant to be, okay, I'm going to go on a good vacation, I'm going to spend thousands of dollars, is not there anymore. And then to the other point that I made on the luxury brands, so the rich are still going to buy, but the upper middle class who wanted to make that jump into like, okay, now I can afford to spend a few thousand dollars on, say, a wallet or a pen or something, I'm not going to do that. So kind of the luxury, the buyers for the luxury market has also seen like a split, which is like going to keep buying. But the ones who want, the aspiring luxury consumers, will curtail spending.
I love this. This is so useful to know. Let me get back to my typical questions, which is, I'm going to send you back to your childhood now for a bit. And you already talked a little bit about fixing your kitchen table and chair, and that was the beginning of your interest in engineering. But can you share a couple of incidents from your childhood that you believe made you into the person you are today?
Yeah, Marie, you get me thinking, so, which is great. So I love this question and I really love sharing a couple of stories in my life that have changed the person I am. So I remember while I was growing up, I had a good childhood, as a lot of kids would perceive their childhood. Like I got the toys I wanted. My parents did everything, obviously, in their capacity to be able to give me what I needed as a kid to be happy. So I went to a good school. I had all the stuff I needed, the toys, the friends and everything. And then while I was in second or third grade, about 10-year-old boy, my family, we were all, while growing up in Mumbai, India, my family was joined. We were living together in a big house. And due to some issues with the family business, we had a separation in the family where we kind of started living separately. And there were some financial issues which affected me as a kid. And from a little boy of 10 years old, where I had everything I wanted for a couple of years. My parents were going through financial issues where they had to start their own business, putting all the money they had. So the period of those 2-3 years is when I faced the real life as a kid. If I hadn't seen the luxuries before, I wouldn't ever know what they are. But having seen the luxuries while growing up, when I was 10 to 12 years old, and when I did not have it, I was deprived of what I had before, from having a really good car to go to school, I had to go walking. It wasn't too far. It was a couple of miles. But so kind of seeing that difference in life made me kind of go back. My parents, again, they did what they could, but they were kind of building up their life back again. So those 2-3 years really transformed the way I thought about life. From a boy who is always in, hey, I'm going to study just because I have to do it, like check the box. As a little boy, I kind of changed my thought process that I have to focus on education. Education is a way I will get into a good school. I will get a good job. I will make good money and be happy. And it's not just like getting a good job and having a 6- or 7-figure paycheck is not the answer, but be in a respectful profession, feel good about my life and what I've done. So that's when I started kind of thinking about what I want to do and kind of reshape how I want to focus on my life. So that was the first turning point and kept going when I kind of reached 10th or 11th grade. And then that's the time when I was like, okay, I worked so hard. And now this is the next step where I want to get into, do well in my entrance exams to get into a good engineering school. So that's the second point where I was like, I'm going to give it all I have. Whatever you did before this probably doesn't matter as much as this 1 year. So that's the second time where I just kind of focused on what I had to do and to be able to get into a good school. So I got into one of the really good engineering schools in Mumbai. And then after that, I've just been focused on my career. Obviously have a balanced personal life too. But then kind of these instances, when I think back, the episode with my family is kind of what changed my perception. And when I look back, I hated those 2-3 years because as a kid, all you remember is, hey, are my parents able to give me everything I want? And you kind of keep comparing yourself to your peers. But I'm glad I faced that, those 2-3 years, which were not pleasant at all. They've changed me. They've changed me, the person I am today. I know how it is to hustle and work hard to do what you want. And all of us, for those that are listening here and who are a little bit younger, nothing's impossible. For a person who grew up in Mumbai in a school and to where I am today, and I'm 32, I never thought I would ever achieve what I've done today. If you don't keep putting down goals, keep focusing on them. And once you achieve them, don't stop there. You got to keep going for the next one and kind of have those 2-3 year sprints of goals and enjoy along the way. I can keep going on this topic because I'm really passionate about it, but that was kind of the episode in my life that transformed and it made me what I am today.
Well, I think it gave you a perspective of what it's like to live where you have to struggle for existence and where you don't have to struggle for existence. And I would think it would have made you more sensitive to a larger context than you would have been otherwise. So you were able to see the global perspective on the economy started with that experience. Now you're doing global perspective work, really. It's sort of like it was really a significant point for that.
Absolutely, Mary. And then the other thing also I would say that from a global learning perspective over the years, being kind of born and raised in India. And then I moved while I started my first job about 12, 13 years back. I have worked across the globe. So starting with kind of a lot of work within Asia. So India, Singapore, China, Japan, the full Asian region, then kind of moving more towards the Middle East, Oman, Dubai, Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, like all of those countries. And then now most of my work over the past 10 years has been in kind of the EMEA, kind of so the Europe region, most of the countries. I've done a lot of work with Germany, Portugal, the UK, Switzerland and whatnot. And then obviously the US and Canada, so North America. So kind of having these interactions to your point, every interaction, be it like a 5-minute conversation or like a 6-month project, has made me learn a lot about people, about cultures, about how people think, about how the economies in these countries operate. What are the tax laws? What are the legal regulations? So you pick up a lot. And I would say it's more valuable than if I would just like do a course in, say, the global economy. So more of the practical and the interpersonal skills, I would say, have taught me a lot about these economies and countries and the global market than just like reading books, or if I were just like maybe doing like a white paper or something, that wouldn't have. It's just the real experiences that have really taught me a lot.
Yeah, so you had those real experiences and you also have a strong academic background that helps you to reflect and to think things through. I was just thinking, actually, you were saying earlier about connecting with people across cultures also made me think of Mahatma Gandhi, who I'm going to paraphrase as saying something to the effect of, I want all the cultures and religions of the world to blow through the windows of my house, but I don't want to be blown down by any of them. And the reason I was thinking of that is because I wanted to ask you, so you're born into an Indian culture and you're born in Mumbai, and India is very diverse. So it's not like there's just one thing, but India is almost like a region when you think about it. There's regional influences, national influences. Mumbai would have had its own culture as a city. So when you're born into that, what would you say has influenced you from that culture that you can maybe pinpoint now? It might be other groups too. It might be sort of the social class that you belong to or the family group. It could also be the religion that you were born into. Whether you were practicing it or not, it would still have affected you.
Sure. Yeah. So I think it was more of my school. So even though we were all in Mumbai, we kind of lived maybe a few miles from the school. So it was more of like a regional thing within the city. But then it was more of how diverse the people were. So there were people, to your point, of like different religions, they practiced different, they spoke at home, their first language or whatnot was a little bit different. Obviously, we all spoke in English in school, but it was all very different. So kind of starting with that as a kid of like how different religions, how different communities, be it social, financial, religious or whatnot, they kind of come to harmony. They still learn to live together, learn to communicate together for everyone's good. So that was the starting point. And then throughout my career, as I've kind of progressed, moved from India to the States here, studied and worked abroad across different countries, it's really, I think, the same core value where all of us are in it because we want to be there. So be it where you're located or you're working for a company or even like going to a religious place to worship. So it's kind of, you're there because you want to be there. And it doesn't matter where you come from, but it matters what you're doing in that moment. And I think that's what gave me a realization of, okay, I'm here because I want to be here. And then the other people are there for a reason. So it's more of like mission driven that we are here because we all want to be here. And then where you're from doesn't matter. What you do doesn't matter much when you put it in that context. It's like, I want to know the other person, irrespective of what caste, color, religion, where he's from, whether he's of what ethnic origin and whatnot. So that's kind of something that I really, even while working with different people, I kind of obviously learn a lot with by interacting with people from different religions, cultures, regions across the world, but kind of knowing that we're in it together and we're in it for our own good would be, I think it is something that's stuck with me throughout.
Yeah, you know, people I interview often say something similar to what you're saying, but I'm really more interested in the personal for this particular thought. And the reason I'm thinking about it is, for example, there's a very strong emphasis on education as a means to move yourself up, which you've spoken about right from the very beginning. And I would say that's a very strong emphasis in the way people from India think about life. You know, it's very much education oriented, and people will go to great lengths to make sure their children get the absolute best educational opportunities that they possibly can expose them to. So I don't know if you see that as being a cultural influence, but I certainly see that in the friends that I have that are from India.
Absolutely. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I think in India, and my personal experience as well, like when we grow up, for the most part, parents kind of decide what the kids do. So for me personally, my mom's a lawyer, my dad's an master's of business. So they're all professionals. And then they landed up doing business. So while growing up, my parents decided, hey, Rohan's going to be an engineer. So when I was growing up, they put it in my head, whether if you ask me as a 10-year-old kid, do I want to be an engineer? I didn't know what does engineering even mean. So I was coached into, hey, you'll be successful only if you're either an engineer or a doctor or an attorney. So that's what most of the Indian parents say, I would say. So
yeah, the only other alternative apparently is social disgrace. Social disgrace.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is really unfair because what economy works on three professions? None. We need everybody in every kind of talent, but still it does tend to be an orientation. You know, you've traveled around the world and you have lived in different countries. So is there something you feel you've adopted into your leadership style or your cultural practices that's come from you being outside of India?
So one of the top thing that comes to mind, and I think I can say it confidently that I've grown as a person and kind of really practiced this one skill, is to be inclusive. So I've started in companies from kind of the lowest level and then grown within. And I really appreciate it as I was growing within the firm, people who really appreciate your thoughts and ideas, irrespective of what level you are. So when I started my professional career, I experienced that. And then as I grew within the company and I was a manager, senior manager and whatnot, that's something I consciously practiced, that irrespective of where you're from, who you are, even if you're an intern who's been with the company for 2 days, the intern can have greater ideas than the CEO because that person comes in with a new perspective but that no one else in the company has. And they're going to be biased towards the company because they've been there longer. So that's something I've practiced. So as a part of my culture within my teams today, I always, if there's any big decision or kind of a new project, a new idea we are trying to implement, I get everyone on the in the team in kind of for a whiteboarding session and everyone's voice is heard. I make sure everyone puts their ideas on the whiteboard and then we tackle it as a team. And it's not that, hey, I'm the leader or the manager on the project is guiding the team. Obviously, you need to facilitate to get it in an organized manner. But then everyone's thoughts and voices are heard. That's something I think inclusiveness is what I really appreciated while I was growing up. It got me more motivated to speak up. And I've been practicing that over the years. And I think it's worked out well.
Mm-hmm. So you did experience it as you were growing up, but you felt you honed it through your experiences working with other cultures. Did I get that right?
Absolutely.
Great. So I wanted to also ask you about your temperament and your personality. So, you know, people are born with a certain kind of temperament, and people will say, oh yeah, that's how Rohan was since the time he was little. We would have expected that of him. And they'll say that about you when you're like 65 or 80. So that's the part of you that doesn't change. And then your personality, of course, is how you've responded to what happened to you in your life and what you've grown out of that. What would you say is your temperament? What were you born with? What's really Rohan's temperament?
I think the skill or the temperament that was probably clubbed together. Growing up, I've been really organized in my studies and my work and whatnot. Every day I wake up, the night before I have a list, and I'm still a paper pen guy. I follow that way better. I have a list of things to do, be it in my work or personal life. I have things to do for the next day. So I think over the years, that's what's it's a small thing for people to follow, but that's really helped me stay organized, stay on top of things. And I have a little bit of fear of missing out on things. So I want to be on top of it. If a deadline is in a month, I want to be done 2 weeks prior sort of thing. So that's something that's always been with me and stuck with me through and through. The other question that you asked around what I've picked up along the way is something about cultures and people. So while I moved around, a lot of people, to your point, and nothing against anyone, like everyone's free to live the way they want to, but a lot of people from, say, India or different countries, they stick with people who they feel more comfortable with. Growing up in India, I would stick with my 5 Indian friends and not mix around with people, even though I'm, say, in US or Canada, and I have people who born and raised here who are from different perspectives, just for the feeling of comfort and not wanting to venture out from my comfort zone. So that's something that a lot of people do. But the thing that I've picked up along the way is I've seen people who blend into other cultures, who mix around, who learn the local language, a local sport, a local cuisine. They are more well-rounded professionals and they have stronger, attractive personalities as they grow in their life. So that's something, honestly, I did not practice. The first time I ventured out of my comfort zone from India, I was very uncomfortable. I'm like, what's happening? I don't feel like mixing around. And then I kind of started forcing myself because I saw people that didn't do it and I saw people that did it. And the ones that did, they were happier. They had more friends. They were more likable. And who doesn't want to be more likable? So I started doing that. And I've, again, practiced that over the years and I'm still doing it. It's not that I completely am an outward, outgoing person and mix around with everyone, but I would say I'm 80, 90% there. And that's something that I've picked up along the way and that's helped me. So if you ask me kind of the two things at my core, one is like being organized. That's something I probably was born with and I've been doing it for all of my life. And then two is just forcing myself to be more acceptable of the culture and blending in to what's out there than just being in my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. Those are great examples. And you need to feel rooted in your own culture. When you venture out the first time, it can be very frightening and difficult. But if you realize, like you did, that what you wanted to attain requires you moving outside of the groups that you already know, and you do it, that really speaks to your curiosity, your courage, and your focus on pursuing your goals. People can notice that something looks good, but then they say, oh yeah, but I'm just so much more comfortable here with my friends. And I always remember when I was in high school and people were deciding what they were going to do after they finished high school. And almost everybody said, well, I don't know, what are my friends doing? And it always struck me as being so odd. Why are you placing your future in the hands of whatever happens to be popular among your friends at the time? It just seemed strange to me. And what you're saying is, I would like to be more likable, more well-rounded, happier, more relaxed in a variety of different settings. And therefore, I'm going to push myself outside of my comfort zone so that I can learn how to do that.
Yep, absolutely. And it's uncomfortable when you do it the first few times that I'm going to push myself. It's just like when a person's trying to transform their body or their mind, you got to push yourself to go to the gym, to eat healthy. In a similar way, I would say it's very uncomfortable the first few days or the weeks you do it. You got to force yourself, hey, I'm going to go for this event. I'm going to go and meet people, even though I feel like sitting on the couch and watching TV with my two friends who I feel more comfortable with. So it's uncomfortable, but you got to do it if you want to grow.
Yeah, because what feels natural and what feels authentic is usually a result of what you've been exposed to. So when you practice outside of that comfort zone of what's natural and what's authentic to you, it feels like you're not being true to yourself or that, and it feels unnatural. But the more you practice it, the more natural and authentic it feels. And you also find your own voice in that. So you don't just become the other group, you become yourself within that group.
Absolutely. It's like a dish, right? To make a really tasty salad, like a whole salad, you need the veggies, you need the protein, you need salt, you need pepper. So if you're pepper in the salad, that doesn't mind. You might feel totally different from the veggies and the salt, but you need the pepper to make the salad worthy of it, right? So
I really like that analogy. Yeah, you might feel a little bit odd if you're the pepper in the salad, but you're necessary to the whole and everything is better because you're there. I really like
exactly.
That. That's such a great analogy. So can you recall a time when you felt, and I'm sure this has happened to you and probably does happen to you almost every day, given what you do for a profession, but a time when you've had a kind of a cultural disconnect and you just felt like, ooh, I thought that was the normal way of doing things. And it turns out it's only my own cultural orientation or my own experience that is framing this, and it's not really what is true for other people.
On this one, I'll probably give an example from the first time I presented. We were doing a client pitch. I was, I would say, 1 year into the firm. I was the junior most person on the team, and we were presenting to our client's board of directors for a new project. So my partner, who's my team leader, he asked me to present a couple of slides. And in the Indian culture or the way we are taught, we just a small thing, but for the most part, we're not very concise with topics and with the conversation. So the first time I did it, I was speaking to every word, every bullet on the slide. And it was a little bit like I kept going for this two-sided practice and didn't like voice over everything before the meeting, but I was a little bit elaborate. So for the two slides, others like had 5-6 slides or pages. They took, say, 2 minutes per page. I took about 5 or 6 minutes. So no one said anything to me in the meeting, but that was more driven by the culture I grew up in, the way everyone did it. So it was kind of ingrained within my system that, hey, that's how you got to do it, because that was the right fit. But then when I moved to the States, that's not how, for the most part, it's also a company culture or the team culture, but for the most part, people are a little bit concise. They hit a few quick things on the page, like key messages, and then move on. So after meeting my partner, my leader, he called me aside. He's like, what was the learning? And I was like, I think I did well. And then he said, no, you didn't. You did well, but you could have done better. And I asked him why. And then he said that people have a very short attention span, like you and I do. So hit two quick things and move on. If people are curious, they're going to ask you questions about it. So this is what he said to me. You don't have to give them the formula of all the ingredients. You just got to tell them how it tastes. And if they like it, they're going to ask you what's in it. So that stuck with me, something I've practiced. So from a person who used to be elaborate, kind of speak to everything on a slide, and that's something I do for a living every day, being able to skim the top, talk about the important things, kind of the 80-20 rule, speak about the 80 most important things in 20% of the words. So just kept following it. And I think I've just kind of, I feel great, gotten better at it every day.
Well, there's a sales principle in that a confused customer never buys. And when you give a lot of information, the customer is confused. So when you keep it more concise, they're more likely to buy. Then the other piece was, if you give people too much information, then they have nothing left that they need. So if you give them some of it and leave them hungry, then they're going to come back for more food. So I think that that's probably what you learned. But on the other hand, coming from a different cultural perspective, people may be expecting, like if you were doing the presentation in India, they would be expecting you to go through the details. And if you didn't, they would think that you had not been rigorous enough and that you were not following through properly. So if you were in India, you would need to change that. But in the United States, it's sort of like the approach is different, And even if we look at it from the brain science point of view, from multiple studies in different countries, they would say this piece about, you know, you remember certain points and then you become clear about what you want. That doesn't mean it's going to be culturally accepted or culturally appropriate. So you probably have to tailor your presentation differently depending on who you're speaking to. But maybe that's not entirely true in a global business culture because people are expecting a variety of cultural styles. I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah, I think that's right. Maybe that's why the trailers for movies are made, right? Like you got to show the 20% that makes a person, human tendency makes a person more interested, and then leave the rest for later. So they're going to be drawn in. I think that's one, which is a normal human behavior. And then to your point, right? Like cultures might be different. So it's Europe's different than like India, as I said, people are more elaborate. The ads are elaborate. Everything is elaborate, which is not bad. Like it serves the purpose and that's how it is. Europe, I've seen they're a little bit between the East and the West. I think all the full region is a little bit kind of midway as it is. And then in North America here, we are a little bit concise. Again, it depends on industry. If you're in like a creative industry, like marketing, advertising and whatnot, you got to be able to tell the story well. So that's more concise. But in at least I can talk to my profession, like anything in the finance, strategy, mergers and acquisitions world, concise is key. So you got to hit the two things. And it's not about telling the story. It's telling about the more important things of the story. So kind of it differs based on culture, based on the profession, based on obviously time that people have. Like initial part of COVID, there was a lot of time to tell all the stories because there were people had all the time to hear. But now, like as the economies are picking up, businesses are picking up, people are short on time because they're not used to being so busy in the past 1 year.
Yeah, and they might be also tired of being on screens.
Exactly.
But that was a great point, though, about how when the circumstances changed, people changed. So when COVID first hit, people were more interpersonal. They were asking more deep questions. They were listening to people's stories and telling you a lot more stories. Now that's not as much the case. Things are consistently dynamic. Like what you said in the very beginning about being dynamic, I think you're probably very good at responding to dynamic situations. That's probably your superpower based on what you've said so far.
Thank you, Maria. And I think one other point I would make to this topic is it also depends on the channel. So one is culture, the other one is situation, and the third dimension to that is channel. So COVID working virtually is a perfect example. Like if you ask me today, hey, can you give like a speech for an hour, like a monologue on like a Zoom or a virtual channel, I wouldn't be so excited. But today, given most of us are locked down for like over 6 months now. If you tell me, hey, do you want to go up to like a local school or a local event and give a speech? I could do a speech for 4 hours because I am looking forward to it. I've been deprived for the past 6-8 months to be able to see people, to be able to connect with people in person. So again, the kind of the third channel, which is maybe a little bit minor than the first two, but I think that plays into the whole how you communicate across cultures and people.
So well said. So we're getting close to the end of the interview, and I wanted to ask you, when people hired you for the job or when you're working with mergers and acquisitions, you probably have to set some parameters to make sure that you're not like the ping pong ball in between the different companies. So how do you explain to people what's the best way to work with you, with work with Rohan to get the best out of you?
Sure. So the first thing there is around the overall governance model. So as a part of an M&A transaction or a deal, there are multiple parties involved. So one is a buyer, the other one is a seller. And then those are the two most important things. Like there's no deal without a buyer and a seller. So that's the first thing. And two is there are supporting parties. So like a consulting company like mine helps or advises either a buyer or a seller. So we are advisors. Then you need lawmakers or the attorneys. So there are law firms who actually do the paperwork. So the actual agreements, the employees, clients, and whatnot. And then the third piece of it is banks. So without a money deal or raising funds, the buyer is not going to be able to buy anything for the most part. So those are the key players. So I think starting off at the highest level, before even I get involved, it's like, okay, we know the company-wide roles. So the lawyer is going to do all the agreement work. We're going to advise across the board. The investment banks are responsible for anything, any validation that they need to make to be able to provide the money to make the deal happen. So that's at the highest level. And then two is when I start a project or start engaging with new people, I always, it's not that, hey, this is how you work with me, but I kind of pivot it and be like, okay, what's the best way for all of us to work, right? So that's how I start. And then even within my team, that, hey, we have different people, we are working for the first time, we have different skill sets, what's the best way to work? So I think operating even like inter teams or intra teams, so within your own team or working with different teams like yours, that's how I start on how we can all, we all want to make this a success. We all want to make it more productive and make it better for all of us and our clients. That's how we get paid. So that's how I start. And then two is, as I said, make it inclusive. So rather than, hey, this is the agenda, we're going to follow it no matter what, I make it more inclusive that, okay, this is the goal for the discussion. This is the goal for these 2 weeks. How do we achieve it? So when everyone's on board with the plan, that's when I execute it. So kind of making it more inclusive. And then obviously three is, everything is not rosy in the corporate world or when you're working with different personalities. There's always politics, ego clashes, people feel bad about things and work products. So just to be able to manage all that is something I've learned over the years. And those are kind of the three or four things I would say that when I work on anything, those are the guardrails that I put. And it's been, for the most part, obviously there are learnings along the way. Every interaction or every project is learning, but it's worked well, I would say, in terms of the ground rules or ways of working.
So focus on the goal, be collaborative, find ways to practice inclusion, stay organized with the execution of the project, and then be willing to negotiate when things come up that you weren't expecting.
Absolutely. And last thing is celebrate when you finish it, when you win, when you do it together. Because that's when the clients want to work with you more. That's when you appreciate yourself and your team of doing a great job.
No kidding. Without the celebration, there's not going to be a return. It's just like, thank God that's over.
You bet.
So is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, Marie. I think we covered most of it. And the one thing I would like to say is, firstly, I would like to thank you for giving me this opportunity. I really appreciate it. As I said, while growing up, I was a person who wasn't comfortable speaking about myself or my experiences. So I was kind of more of an introvert. But over the years, I have forced myself, as I said, to take those opportunities. And today, I feel comfortable in having a conversation. So I really appreciate when you reached out, I was excited. So I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity. And two is, for anyone and everyone who's listening, I think as you kind of heard this conversation, like, nothing's impossible, right? All of us have different backgrounds. We come from different parts of the world, have different, we're born and raised in a different way. So just kind of set the goal and work towards it. You might achieve 60, 70, 80% of it, but you'll still be better than not even like starting it. So those are the two messages I would love to give back.
That is wonderful. Goes perfectly with us promoting our productivity tools 2021 coming up. All about setting goals for the 12 months of the year in ways that people can be supported. But that you probably would like to promote something. Tell me, what would you like to promote? That this is like your promo spot. And we'll also put any links that you provide into the show notes. But what would you like to let people know about? It can be something to do with your business and your job role, or it could be something else that you're passionate about that you would like to make sure our listeners hear about.
Yeah, one of the things, and more of like a community building or collaboration than a promotion, is I'm really passionate about where the economy is going and what's happening in the world. So I'm not a big investor by any means, but I love seeing how the market's going up and down and how we can make the most of it. So for anyone who's interested in stock trading or investing, I would love to connect and we can learn from each other. I don't offer advisory services, but it'll be good to kind of learn from each other, build a community so everyone can benefit from that.
That's wonderful. People need to pay attention to finances. It's so critical to watch the trends and to pay attention to finances. I spoke this week to three people who are in their 70s and 80s who have not paid attention to their finances. And here they are now in the last years of their life with nothing there to support them financially. And they're going, why didn't I wake up sooner? Nobody should be in that position if they start thinking about it now. Take advantage of tools that are out there. Connect with people who want to talk about money, about investing, about savings, about making sure that you make wise financial decisions. It's so important for the health of individuals, their families, their communities, and really the whole world.
Absolutely. And the two keywords there is start small and start early. So for all the young professionals who just started their jobs, no amount, even a $10 bill is good enough to get started. So start small, start early.
Yeah, I just now have to add on one more thing because you made me think of something else. So there used to be an insurance product where it was a disability insurance for business owners, where if you didn't use that product, that you would get like 65% of the money that you put, you invested into it back. It doesn't exist anymore because obviously it wasn't very good for insurance companies to make money. But my husband invested in that when he first started his profession 40 years ago. And he has since, as a result of that, received three times large sums of money coming as a result of having gone for several years for not using his disability business insurance. And he was able to put that towards other financial goals. And that was because he started putting $125 a month into this when he was 20. And it's reaped results for him all through his life because of thinking when he was young about how he should make good financial decisions. But when people are older, they can still make good financial decisions to make some repairs, but so much easier if you start when you're younger, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Yep. And on that point, I just want to keep it short. So I actually forgot to mention is that I actually started investing and started actually managing my family's investment portfolio when I got out of bachelor's degree or undergrad. So right when I was 19, I think 20 years old, is when I started. And initially, I obviously didn't make the money. I probably lost a little bit. But then over the years, it's actually got me a lot of financial discipline in managing. My family just gave me, my dad gave me like, hey, this is our portfolio. I've made some kind of one-off decisions over the past, not in an organized manner. It's on you to make it organized. So I started there, started investing for them, for me, and like multiple asset classes. And over the years, I've grown it three times. So it's been a long journey. But then if you learn financial discipline, you learn discipline in life. Because when you lose money, that's the worst feeling ever that you get. That because it's all hard earned, it's blood and sweat that's put into that. So that's something I'm really passionate about. That's why I kind of offered up that, hey, anyone who wants to be on the same journey that I've been, would love to connect and love to collaborate.
Wonderful. We'll put that contact information into the show notes. And thank you, Rohan, so much for this insightful and fascinating interview.
Thank you, Marie, for having me. Really appreciate your time and for the interesting questions.
Rohan Nigam's life of analysis, highly specialized expertise, and rigorous pursuit of goals has resulted in his current role as director of PwC's deals practice, a coveted corporate position. This interview was an intellectually satisfying experience for me, but what I really loved was Rohan's explanation of the benefits of cross-cultural learning as he compared it to a tasty salad. Although I have certainly heard both salad and soup metaphors to describe the experience of learning to cross cultures, it was delightful to imagine actually being one of the ingredients in the salad. Rohan said, to make a really tasty salad, you need the veggies, you need the protein, you need the salt, you need the pepper. So if you're the pepper in the salad, you might feel totally different from the veggies and the salt, which led me on a very interesting journey of imagining cultures from the perspective of being a vegetable or a spice. I'm thrilled that you were able to join me on this interview with Rohan Nigam. It is such a privilege to be allowed a window into another person's life in this way, and then to be able to present it for others to savor. Thank you for listening. Please share the episode with a friend or colleague, and may culture and leadership connections continue to guide and inspire your day. This podcast would not be possible without the expertise of our culture and leadership connections production team. A big thank you and shout out to Mike Kurlander for audio production and editing, to Malvika Kathpal for the show notes, Bernadette Guadiz for online web and social media management and promotions, Celine Bayogo for design, and Kirsten Hoyer for website and branding. Thank you so much. Hey, Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners, I have three great ways you can show your love for a fabulous podcast. Number one, follow thepodcast.com/culture and leadership. This link lets you follow our podcast instantly on any directory you choose. Number two, lovethepodcast.com/culture and leadership. This link lets you rate and review the podcast with two clicks. Number three, patreon.com/culture and leadership connections. This is a link for serious fans who want to get in on some bonus content. We have cross-cutting themes, a monthly discussion on Discord, extra podcasts, guest video interviews, and inside scoop videos with team members. I know you'll love it. And you can help us continue to create our stellar shows with a tiny monthly subscription at the same time. So if you aren't following, go to followthepodcast.com/culture and leadership. If you're already following, go to lovethepodcast.com/culture and leadership. And if you've already rated and you're still following and you still love it and you're a big fan, go to patreon.com/culture and leadership connections. Thank you in advance for being a fan and for helping support creative, honest, and authentic podcast productions.